Good afternoon, go ahead and be seated. All right, let's see, is Justice Pickering? There she is. So I'm going to be conducting the proceedings from up here. And so, first order of business, calling case number 90281 Midtown 44. Versus George E. Lorton. Counsel, you ready to proceed?
I am.
Do you want to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay.
I beg you?
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is John Wright. I represent the appellants Midtown 44 and the Pepper Group, Nevada. This case is about Mr. Lorton, who's here with us today, claiming nearly 30 years after he purchased a property from the now deceased Mr. Lavaldi, that in addition to the easements that were meticulously set forth in a recorded deed finalizing the transaction, there was yet another easement that was part of the same deal. This appeal is about the district court misapplying the restatement of property servitudes, section 2.16, paragraph 2, to the facts of this case, which, in my opinion, does great violence to some established rules concerning transactions of real property in the state, including the parole evidence rule, the doctrine of merger by deed, and the statute of frauds. The deed in this state, under the doctrine of merger by deed, is an integrated document, and the district court erred by ignoring that the statute of frauds had been satisfied, allowing parole evidence to modify the terms of the deal nearly 30 years after the fact. The court did this by using the restatement third 2.16 paragraph 2, which is a provision for prescriptive easements, specifically when there is no writing, when the statute of frauds has not been satisfied. And of course, in this case, we do have a deed. It lays out several easements. It is the final expression of the parties. And according to this court in Reno versus Matley, the full execution of the contract for sale of land is presumed to merge with the provisions of a preceding contract, pursuant to which it is made, including all prior negotiations and agreements. What Mr. Lorton and the appellee's attorney want to do is basically have it both ways. They want to have the benefits of the deed and at the same time claim that the statute of frauds has not been satisfied so that they can employ this particular procedure, which has not been adopted by the court. And I would suggest in this particular instance, it would be the wrong thing to do simply because of the fact that there is a prior recording. That particular provision is really meant for a situation where there's no writings to rely upon, or at least nothing that can satisfy the statute of frauds fully.
So Mr. Wright, but if we look at the conduct of the various parties that owned these two properties over time, isn't that what a prescriptive easement is about? Like over time, everybody has functioned as though Mr. Lorton had an easement or even adverse possession of that piece of property.
No, not exactly. There are two parts of that restatement. The first paragraph deals with what you just mentioned, adverse. That is not the situation here whatsoever. There's no adversity. Everybody agrees he had permission to use that lot. The question is whether or not that was intended to be a permanent fixture, or was it just something that could have been revoked unilaterally by the Serbian property. This is actually specifically mentioned.
Was there any indication that there was that danger?
That there was a what?
There was that danger of it being revoked based upon...
You mean in terms of the conduct of the parties? Well, as you know, my client is new to the situation. was not there for that timeframe, according to the.
Knew about it before they closed on the property.
That is correct. He knew about it before they closed on the property, knew that there was an issue, but of course, doing his due diligence, there is no recording of that easement. However, again, prescriptive easement under this particular section is, in this case, has to be with a prior agreement. Okay, so the question becomes, was the prior, if there was a prior agreement, was it just permissive or was it supposed to be permanent? And the drafters of the restatement that's in question here specifically addressed this in two comments, this exact basically scenario, and cautioned. It said, number one, in comment H, if I can quote it, claims based on oral grants or agreements should be accepted cautiously because they directly thwart the purpose of the statute of frauds. To force parties to provide written evidence of the existence and terms of interest in land. In this case, the only written document we have is the deed. Mr. Lorton did not present a purchase and sale agreement. There's no writings from the prior owner, Mr. Lorardi. There's nothing to suggest that. In fact, the evidence that they did present, which was that he used it permissibly, that he contributed somewhat to its repair over the course of 30 years, although the court decided that that wasn't enough for adverse possession. That's the same evidence that you would see if it were a revocable license. There's no difference between the two. There's nothing in the record whatsoever to suggest that it was meant to be permanent, other than Mr. Lorton's testimony. And in fact, because we have a recorded deed, the court really should have focused its attention solely on interpreting that document. If you go to comment I of the same restatement that the court relied upon, it says, in determining whether neighbors who contribute to facilities or services for the mutual benefit, and this is mutually beneficial, that pavement went through the entire parking lot, not just this one little section, the whole thing. In determining whether neighbors who contribute to facilities or services for their mutual benefit are acting on the basis of an implied understanding that the arrangement is revocable by any of them unilaterally or is binding on them and their successors, the factors that should be considered, and there are several, but the last one is the likelihood that the parties would have entered into a permanent arrangement without committing it to writing. The chances that these parties would have entered into a permanent arrangement without committing it to writing are zero. How do we know that? Because the deed actually has three easements clearly stated in it. If the parties intended to have another permanent arrangement, all evidence indicates that they would have put it in the deed where they put the other easements. There's nothing that contradicts the deed. No evidence would really be admissible to do that because it would violate the parole evidence rule. But the parties were very careful to place that in there. In fact, there were actually three grantors, which is not mentioned very often. Mr. Lorardi was only one of them, of the three parties that own that property, and all three parties signed their name to that deed expressing exactly what was being transferred. And there's no mention whatsoever in there. In fact, there's no mention of it in the deed to my client's property, although the other easements are also mentioned in there.
But doesn't that undermine the whole concept of an intended but imperfectly created servitude?
No, I don't think so, because if you accept their argument, it completely undermines the statute of frauds.
Well, if a prescriptive easement comes into place by operation of law rather than a written conveyance, why does parole evidence come in at all?
Because of the fact of the merger by deed doctrine. You have to start with there, which is that all communications and negotiations concerning that transaction, everybody agrees there's one transaction. Mr. Lorton testified to that. It's in their brief. It's in their complaint. He would not have purchased this property, he states, without that being part of the deal. That means there's one transaction. And under the parole evidence rule, under statute of frauds, under the merger by deed doctrine, All of the understandings are contained in the deed. So the analysis has to begin with, do we have a written agreement between the parties? Why are we trying to deviate from it? What rule allows us to deviate from the terms of a fully integrated document? There's only two exceptions, fraud and ambiguity. There's no allegation of fraud, and there's nothing ambiguous about the deed. They're adding terms to it. That's completely violative of the parole evidence rule. And the parole evidence rule comes into play because of the merger by deed doctrine says this is the final agreement between the parties. This is what we look to. So I understand what you're saying that, well, what about the prescriptive aspect of this? It's based on usage. It's not based on usage entirely. It's also based on proving that there was an agreement.
Mr. Wright, if we can move past that for a moment, the statute of frauds, the parole evidence, can there be an exclusive easement here? And how does Jones versus Gadeere play into all this?
Yeah, that was another, yes, exactly. I don't think there can be. Number one, I'm not sure where that even comes from. If you look at the court's order, it gives them an exclusive and perpetual easement on that property. If you go back to the deed, any of the three easements that are contained in there, none of them use the word exclusive. So where did the court get the intent from?
The fence easement was exclusive, right?
The which one?
The fence, the 8 feet for the fence.
The fence is not, the fence is actually, no. It's not exclusive. In fact, I went through it again. I mean, I don't think the word exclusive appears in there. I went through it again. And which is interesting, Judge, because of the fact that that particular part, that 8 foot, it's 8 foot wide, it's actually like 25 feet long. The fence completely divides that easement from where the RV is parked presently. That's not even exclusive, although you would think it should be simply because who else would be using that? It surfaces their roll-up door. There's a complete solid barrier with the fence from my client's property and everybody else. It's still not exclusive. It's still, we could park there if we wanted to. But no, and the Gadeere case.
Gadeere.
The comprehensive prescriptive easement is effectively what she provided. And you know, this court said, we're not gonna do that if somebody hasn't paid their taxes, because basically they're getting the benefit of an adverse possession, you're getting full title without having paid the taxes, without actually assuming the responsibilities of ownership. But the court did it inexplicably. I think that kind of goes to the whole problem of there's been never an analysis of what the intent is. If you go back to the deed, you'd see what the intent is. How did they get from, you know, oh, it's an easement to it's, by all intents and purposes, ownership? That's not explained. Although Mr. Lorton, his testimony changes back and forth because at times it's talking about an easement and at times he says, well, I owned it. I owned that. If you owned it, we're talking about something completely different than a prescriptive easement. So I don't know if there was any analysis really into the intent given the diversity of the testimony considering, is it ownership? Is it an easement? We have a deed that is never discussed by the court in any respect. And so, yeah, exactly. The second point I was gonna make was about Gadeere. And I think that clearly the court made a mistake there, but I don't think you get to that simply because I don't think that there is any sufficient basis to deviate from what's contained in the deed. There's no rule that was even employed or suggested that there was ambiguity in the deed, nor fraud. If you don't have any other questions, I reserve the rest of my time for this
possible. Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. Thomas J. Hall for the record, for Mr. Lorton, who's sitting with me. The one thing I think the court should be aware of at the very beginning is the doctrine of merger was not raised in the trial court below. in the reply brief in this case, for the first time, I saw the council advocate for the doctrine of merger and the doctrine of reformation. It was not presented in the affirmative defenses. It was not put into the trial statement. It was never brought before Judge Connie Steinheimer. And so I know the longstanding rule at this court is you can't cite and quote and rely on a doctrine or thought that wasn't in the trial court. There's two principles before the court. One, whether Loraldi could legally grant an exclusive easement for ingress, egress, and parking over the disputed property. Is there any doubt that if he wanted to, he could have signed his name to an exclusive grant of easement? The second question that the court has to decide is whether the findings of the district court are supported by substantial evidence, clear and convincing, that the subject easement was an intended but imperfectly created easement. Under the law of easements, we have kind of two broad categories. On one side are the easements that are created by grant, by agreement, by consent, by dedication. On the other side are easements that are created by adverse possession, prescription, adversity, some form of hostility. So the Jones case that Justice asked about was all about hostility. There was never a purchase agreement. There was never a handshake. There was never paint on the fence showing where the boundaries of the easement were. So the Jones case is not to be relied on because it just is, the facts are completely different. It came out of a wall that had been built by error and used by the Jones for a period of time, and then Mr. Drury wanted it back. And the Supreme Court says you can't get a fee title without paying taxes. We're not here for a fee title, we're here for an easement. Easements by consent are easement granted by dedication, by math, by implication, by intent, but imperfectly created easement. Second category of rights are bound by adversity.
And Mr. Paul, let me ask you a question, though, about Jones versus Guidry. So in that case, it says the crucial difference between adverse possession and an easement is that adverse possession is the exclusive control of the property, while an easement is not. Here, though, if Mr. Lorton continues to use this property as he has, as a parking spot, right, would the owner of the property have any ability? I mean, really, aren't they precluded from using it for whatever they want to use it for? I mean, it's a little different than an easement, say, to get to the property itself. It's
certainly
an easement to use the property.
Absolutely, and the question I asked at the beginning is the landowner allowed to grant an easement for exclusive use? And since you raised that question, Council, or Mr. Justice, I want to just point out the easements in the case. There's a little drawing. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, but it's colorful since I painted it. And there it is. So the first easement is a non-exclusive easement over parcel three, circle parcel three, for access, ingress, parking, etc. The second easement is actually for the building that encroaches onto parcel four by 2 feet. And you asked if that's exclusive, and by all intents, it doesn't say exclusive as council has said, but all intents, it's underlying the property, the building that's on parcel two. And under the Jackson Nash case, that was a 2.6 foot overlap by a building, and the court found that was sustained by operation of law. And so the exclusivity is a question. Then parcel three, easement three, includes the fence and about 8 feet, and that's the green easement on the little sheet. And for all intents and purposes, the fence, which is permitted, prohibits any joint use or shared use. And the easement we're talking about today is the green or the red easement that has been used exclusively by Mr. Loraldi for 27 years. It was visible, it was open. the buyers, who are now the appellants, saw it, knew about it, and actually hired people to ask, talk to them about it. They hired an attorney, they hired a surveyor, they hired a broker, and they came to the conclusion that they could work with Mr. Lorden to work things out down the road, but Mr. Lorden didn't see it that way. He had been using it in his business for a long time. The case that I think the court should be aware of and spend some time with is the Jackson versus Nash case. This was the case for a easement of necessity. And the court really drilled in to the issue of intent. Matter of fact, the court used the word intent 13 times. And in other cases, the court has used the word intent as the driver of what is the explanation of how these property pieces come together. Cox versus Glenbrook is the first case. Jackson versus Nash. Dedication by map is the Shear versus Reno case. And so you go through the cases that are talking about easements, you'll find that the court has used the word intent or intended more frequently than not. The exclusive use doesn't raise a problem to me, because what if you couldn't have exclusive easements? Water companies have water lines, utility lines, exclusive right for an easement for a water tank. Southwest Gas has lots of easements that they protect for the gas lines. When I was early in the years, I was attorney for Heavenly Valley Ski Area. We had ski easements, ski slope, ski run easements, lift line easements. So the easements exclusivity is somewhat of a red herring, because they exist more than you think. In Nevada, there's been a couple cases that dealing with exclusive use. And this comes up a lot of times in parking lot, commercial parking lots, where designated places have been set aside for exclusive use. So the exclusivity doesn't bother me as far as the rainbow of different rights that can be included within the easement. Now, Mr. Counsel has stated that there was nothing in writing. Well, the statute of frauds only prevents the introduction of evidence that is not otherwise supported by operational law. So we have an operational law. All the non-written easements we deal with every day, easement by map, easement by dedication, easement by necessity, all of those are rising by operational law and not by a grant. So the statute of fraud doesn't work. The merger doesn't work because it was never raised. Reformation doesn't work because it was never raised. So we come down to what was the intent of the parties. And if you look at Exhibit 281, which is Volume 2 of the appendix, this was the survey that was done by the surveyor that was hired by the buyers. And if you read it, let's say Easement 2, which is under the building, also together with an easement for a building encroachment within the northerly 2 feet of the following described parcel, the westerly 8 feet of the easterly 108 feet of lot 2 and block 2 of this addition. I had to read this many, many times over just so I could find out where the heck they're talking about. And the same with easement 3, the westerly 8 feet of the easterly 108 feet of lot 2 and block 2. And so it takes the time. That's why I did this little map, so I could even understand what was going on here. So whether Mr. Lorden was at fault at age 25, paying $115,000 for property that was adjacent to his building he was buying, maybe that's why these restatements says it's a title curing process to perfect title. And as you know, if you've read many of these cases on easements, the boundary disputes between neighbors can raise to the and hostility of child custody cases, divorce cases. I've had about 50 years of practice with easement cases, and you'll be surprised how intense feelings are when it comes to easements. So the restatement set a different chart. They said this was an intended but imperfectly created So you get rid of the hostility between neighbors, you stop the fighting, you stop the throwing of objects back and forth, and you find out what the parties intended, just like this court suggested in Nash versus Jackson, Severs versus Zinoff, and the other cases that I have cited. Does the court have any further questions?
How does Nash help us?
Nash is a great case. It's an off-record claim for an easement of necessity. And Nash bought property, and it went over the property owned by Mr. Jackson. They said, we never agreed to it. We never talked about it. You don't get it. And there was an alternate access, although it wasn't very good, kind of a Jeep trail. And the court went on and on and on about the intent of what the parties intended. In that case, they did not find any intent because it was never discussed. Our case is full of discussion, of bargaining, of painting a fence, of a handshake, and things like that.
But is there necessity here?
Say what?
But is there necessity here?
Not a necessity in that way. It's a desired aspect. When Mr. Loraldi bargained for the parcel 2 that he bought with the building, he was interested in having other easements to get to it, which is easement 1, the building easement that sits underneath the building. Easement 3 is behind the fence and an area, and then this area, the red easement, as we call it, was for his staging of his carpet business, his trucks, his vehicles, and the record is replete with pictures of trucks and cars and motorhomes and things parked there. So necessity is not part of this case. A desire to make a bargain is this case.
Let me ask you one more question.
Yes, sir.
The judge here, Judge Steinheimer, granted a perpetual exclusive prescriptive easement, correct?
Yes.
Okay, why wouldn't that be considered a comprehensive prescriptive easement in this case that law doesn't generally allow?
Say again, I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
Why wouldn't that essentially be a comprehensive prescriptive easement, which we don't generally permit under Nevada law?
Yeah, I read that, and comprehensive is a kind of a new animal as far as I'm concerned. California adopted it. It's a kind of beyond the normal parlance of a prescriptive easement. In that case, they wanted exclusive use of the side behind the wall that they hadn't paid taxes on, so they wanted complete exclusion. I did point out in this case, there's a sewer line under this easement. There's an aerial telephone power lines over this easement, plus there's garbage trucks or cans on this property. So we're not talking about that, and I don't see any parallel between the restatement of section 216 and 217 with a comprehensive, and that's why I thought that
but he's essentially seeking exclusive control of that.
That's true.
Yeah,
that is absolutely true.
How do you make a distinction there?
Well, the Jones case was an adverse case. As I said, if you took all the adverse cases on that side of the courtroom and all the consent cases over here, this is a consent case. It's not adverse, it's not a necessity, it's not those other types of unwritten easements. It's an easement that what was intended to be part of the deal. He paid for it, he shook his hand, he wouldn't have bought the property without it, and it just fell through the cracks. So, anyway, that's
my answer. I have a question about the restatement and the imperfectly created easement. In this case, the deed had express easements in it, and your colleague on the other side says there was nothing imperfect about its omission altogether of this easement. So therefore, the restatement 216 sub 2 doesn't apply. Could you comment on that?
Well, it was an imperfect creation of the desire. I thought was they should have hired an attorney, they should have hired an engineer to do a record of survey and a parcel map, but they did it by what we call title company easement, shorthand, the west 2 feet and the 108 feet and whatever. So it was an incomplete document. So to me, it fills the gap between what was intended to what was written. And what was written is pretty hard to understand anyways, and they've had mistakes Matter of fact, the expert that they testified to at trial had a mistake. So all I'm saying is it fills the gap between what's written and what was intended. And the court might not make that gap, might not fill it in. I know that. This court is the final arbiter of what the law should be in the state of Nevada. I'm well aware of that. All I'm saying is...
Under 216, what are the guardrails on somebody just saying, well, it was intended but not expressed, and therefore I should be allowed to come in and claim this by operation of law contrary to the statute of frauds and peril evidence rule and all the rest of it?
There's a couple guardrails, Justice Pickering. One is time. You have to abide by the five-year rule. We have 27 years here. It has to be clear and convincing evidence. Anytime you divert from the written word, you have to have clear and convincing evidence. And you have the trial judge to weigh the evidence, whether it is clear and convincing, whether it's intended. So yes, I would know that my people might try to do this wrongly or unsuccessfully or take a stab at it. But all the other deals we have are the same thing. Easement of necessity, what prevents that? Easement by dedication, easement by intent. It's just the same of the, I call them the rainbow easements. Rainbow, there's all different freight size, flavors, and sizes for easements. Limitation, every easement is limited in some form, so you have to find out what the limits are. Size, shape, duration, use, length of time. So I just think it's one of the bundles of the easement analysis that we go through every single time you have an easement case. Any other questions?
I don't have any, Justice Pickering. Any additional questions?
None further, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Justices.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to follow up with Justice Pickering's question. That's exactly my point, is that there are no guardrails when it comes to the intent of the parties of making it permanent or just voluntary and revocable. The time and the usage and the contribution to its upkeep, those are not guardrails to determining what the party's intent is. That's the first element of paragraph two. They intended to do something, but that it didn't happen. You can't go to the performance afterwards to determine that intent. You have to go back and look, well, wait, what is the most effective means of determining what the intent is? Well, look at the contract. We don't have a contract here. What do we have? We have the deed. The deed satisfies the statute of frauds.
What about, and again, the judge, trial judge, had all of this before her. What about course of conduct over the period of 27 years?
But that, again, that's exactly what I'm saying, though, is that there's two elements. You need to have both the proof, the intent to make it permanent, not just something that can be revoked at any time. You make it permanent by putting it in the deed, like with the other three. And that's exactly the problem, is that somebody can come up at any time and say, you know what? I don't like what was in there. I'm going to attack it now. I'm going to say there was something additional to it. And that's why we have the parole evidence rule. We don't allow prior contemporaneous agreements and it, you know, to attack an integrated document. You adopt this rule under these factual circumstances and grant them what they're asking for, you've completely eviscerated the statute of frauds, the parole evidence rule. In terms of the doctrine by merger by deed, it's not mentioned in name, but it's talked through throughout the entire trial, throughout all the proceedings, because all it is saying that that is an integrated document. Then you get to the parole evidence rule. Okay, because you already have the parole evidence rule because we have a written document, which is the deed. All the merger by deed doctrine says is that the deed is it controls over a prior contract. We don't even have a written contract here to go to. You have the deed because they didn't introduce that to try to say, well, wait a minute, I actually had a written contract and in it, there was this fourth easement. We don't even have that. All we have is his oral testimony about discussions that he supposedly had with somebody that nobody can testify to because that person's deceased. That's the danger. There's no guardrail. Again, what he spoke of go to the second element. They don't go to the intent to make it permanent. That's my issue with it. The intent is contained in the actual document. With respect, going back to the issue of the comprehensive prescriptive easement.
Excuse me, but
I'm sorry.
There's no integration clause, so you do have to get to merger by deed, don't you? I mean, I'm a little.
I don't think you need an integration clause to say that it's a final expression of the parties. If you look at the document and it doesn't mention, we're going to have to do X, Y, and Z, we're going to have to look at this document, this event is going to have to take place, then you know that it's a self-containing document. You don't.
Okay, very good. Justice Pickering, any questions? Any further questions?
No, thank you.
Justice Bell?
Nope.
Okay, counsel, thank you for the briefing and the arguments today. The matter will stand submitted. We'll stand in recess until the next call of the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, we did it.